Welcome to the Microsoft IT Pro Podcast, a show about Office 365, Azure, and the IT Pro and end user side of life. Each week, we'll discuss a different topic or recent news related to Office 365 and Azure and how it relates to you as an IT Pro. The Microsoft IT Pro Podcast is never longer than 30 minutes, so let's get started. How are you on this fine Saturday, Scott?
It's just another day of the week that ends in Y. And if you could see me throwing my hands up and just throwing my head down, it's been a long week.
Kind of like the whole YMCA song. Are you going to start spelling out letters on the video?
Yeah, I'm very glad we don't do video for this one.
We should sometime, just so people can see how much they don't actually want video.
How much messier my office is than yours? Yeah, got it.
No, mine's all hidden down on the floor out of sight.
Ah, that's what I need to do. That's why I leave my camera pointed at the ceiling and the skylight. Just blind everyone.
Exactly. It's the whole waist up thing. Kind of like when you have that shirt you just grab when you have a video call and everything from the waist up is great, but everything else down, we just leave that off camera.
Too much information. I'm never going to view you the same in a Zoom meeting again. Okay, it's a good thing I haven't had too much to eat today. Let's go ahead and get going.
All right, on to our topic. So today, we figured we'd dive into some news. It's been a little while. There's, as always, a whole bunch of news. We sorted through a bunch of it, have some stuff to talk about. So why don't we go ahead and dive into it? You want to kick things off with a news article of choice?
Yeah, so there's been a bunch of stuff we've talked about in the past, and we did an episode recently on a feature in Azure Automation, which was the update management, inventory, and change tracking solution. So that went GA very recently. So that was kind of in a preview mode when we were talking about it. And now it has come out and it has been released. When they decided to release it, they did not fix some of the existing holes in it, like coverage for domain joined machines. So your mileage may vary on where you deploy it. And interestingly enough, when they GA'd this one, they also didn't turn it on in additional automation regions. So you are gated to certain Azure Automation accounts and region dependent in there, but it's not published anywhere. So I have found that East 2 is a really good region, like US East 2, to go ahead and create these things. If you happen to create them in US Central South or something like that, it will probably pop up and say, I'm not actually able to enable this solution because it's just not available in this region. But like I said, not documented anywhere. So hopefully that one continues to get updates and continue to grow because it does provide you some awesome coverage all for free for your Azure machines.
Sounds good. So yeah, go back and listen to the episode. That was just like two or three episodes ago, I think we did that. Might have even been last episode. I can't remember. But yeah, go find out all about that. And US East 2 is by far my favorite Azure region.
It would be, except if you are a Visual Studio subscriber who goes ahead and pulls down your Azure benefits through Visual Studio. They've changed that over the years, and you're gated to just certain regions as a Visual Studio subscriber now. So you can't deploy like VMs into East 2. You're just not allowed to. You're only allowed to go into US East, US West, and a handful of other data centers, but nowhere near the 50 regions that are in production.
Interesting.
It is documented out there on the service availability page and all that good stuff. But, you know, I'm like every other user. I just spun up a new MPN account a couple weeks ago for my new job, and I got really annoyed because I can do it in some of my older MSDN accounts. I can't do it in the newer ones. Yeah, not fun.
All right. So other news, speaking of things that went GA, Power App Studio for the web is now generally available too for production use. So yeah, if you do Power Apps development, if you're working on creating Power Apps, they have that web version of Power App Studio that I didn't actually realize that that has been in preview for all this time, but that is now officially GA now. So you can use that. And I'm going to hit on one other quick one since this one just went GA too. And there's not a lot around it, but we've also talked about guest access for Office 365, adding guests to Office 365 groups. One of the things we always griped about was that while Planner was a part of it, you couldn't have guest access to it. So in addition to the Power Up Studio GAing, now you can also add guests to or Planner now supports guest user access. So again, not a lot of links around this, not a lot of information, because guest access is still guest access. You enable it the same way, you invite users the same way. Planner just now also supports the guest access.
Yeah, no, that's a very good thing. And it's starting to kind of have more coverage across the service, right? So when you go in and look at that table now on the support side and it says, hey, here's what guests can and can't do within Office 365 groups. Yep, one more thing that we can knock off the list. Just go back to the Power Apps Studio for web being available. One of the interesting things is when they announce that, they call out specifically that that's going to become the premier authoring experience for creating Power Apps. And it is, kind of the recommended way to build apps out of that side. So it used to be the web studio was really limited and you had to be on a Windows 10 device and go ahead and get the Power App Studio out of, the Windows Store and drive it through. But what did you do if you weren't a Windows 10 shop? That was kind of a hard thing to accommodate. So that should really lower the barrier to entry for enterprises that are still running older versions of Windows and maybe they just didn't get there from a client perspective yet.
Yeah, I kind of skimmed over that one pretty fast, but I agree. And me, I'm on a Mac too. So obviously I can never install it for Windows 10 without a VM. So I tended to always use the web version anyways. It is nice to see this kind of being that premier editing environment now. So you can do everything on a Mac that you could on Windows 10 when it comes to Power App Studio.
Yeah, the other thing that'll come along with that too is they will deprecate the existing Power Apps for Windows application. So that's going to go away on June 1st, 2018. And then just over to the web. So use the web one. It's there.
Yeah, that's pretty quick. So what, 2 months? That's only 2 months away. Tomorrow's April 1st. Crazy.
Yeah, well, they gave you a little bit of notice, so not the end of the world. And they gave you an equivalent, if not better, authoring experience in theory.
Definitely. So what else do you have? Do you got some more Azure news for us?
There is some Azure stuff, but let's keep going with Office 365 because you brought up the groups and the guest access and all of that good stuff. So there has been a bunch of announcements in the groups space. So one of the bigger ones, which I think is absolutely wonderful. And I've kind of complained about this one in the past. Who knew that I complained about things?
Yeah. What, you? Never.
Yeah. Yeah. So Office 365 groups that are created from Microsoft Teams are going to be hidden from your gal by default because every group gets a mailbox and that mailbox gets an email address. Traditionally, what's happened is those have been pushed into your gal and then you've had to go and hide them later. So that's applied to every group, groups that are created in Teams, groups that were created through Outlook, groups that were created through a SharePoint site that was groupified, or Yammer groups, right? Planner, anything that supported that group workload. So what they're starting to do is dial that back a little bit and recognize that when I create a group through Outlook or Outlook on the web, I'm kind of intending to maybe have a mailbox. And I probably intend for that to show up in other places like the gal and across Outlook on the desktop, whatever that happens to be. And then for something like a team, I might want that to be a more private or enclosed workload. So I still want to have the mailbox. I still want to be able to have the team collaboration and the chat and all the other things. And it needs to be there for the way Teams is architected. But let's go ahead and just hide it from the gal right out of the gate, which will be really awesome.
I like this one too, because like you said, as all these different services spin up groups, I feel like it's a little bit of group overload. So because groups really, like we've said before, under the covers is just that membership platform to drive these different services. Being able to hide those groups or even have them hidden by default in various places, I think will clean up that experience a lot. The nice thing is too with this one, if you do spin it up as a team, you do still want that Outlook experience. They're not saying, hey, it's hidden by default and there's no way to get it back. You can actually use the set unified group commandlet, which is a part of the Exchange Online PowerShell for Office 365. And there is a hide from Exchange clients setting flag on that unified group. So you can kind of enable, disable that if you would want that group to start showing up in Outlook.
Correct. So that's not in the documentation yet. It's only in the announcement that they had that came out. But as long as you're going and pulling the latest version of the Exchange commandlets, which you should be doing, right? Because we're just pulling those down in a PowerShell session live and rare and ready to go. So pretty easy to do. But now you do have to go on a team by team basis and go back to those individual groups if you do want them to show up, right? So there's no on off switch for the entire tenant at this time. So adapt to the new behavior. And you might want to consider going back to your existing teams that are already out there and published in the GAO and maybe going through and doing a quick enumeration or something like that and just scripting that out to make sure that the behavior is consistent for everybody moving forward.
Definitely. And if you want to get really creative and have a default, you just tie in like a group creation trigger with Azure Automate or with a flow with Azure Automation and run PowerShell. Anyways, you can do all kinds of fun things.
All kinds of fun things. And then there's one other groups thing that kind of comes along with this as well. So if you are an Azure AD premium subscriber, so you have access to some of those advanced features in Azure AD, one of those advanced features that relates specifically to Office 365 and groups is expiration policies. So the ability to set a global policy within your Office 365 tenancy and have that spun back out in the form of expiration for your groups, right? So I'm going to set a lifetime for groups based on certain characteristics and then potentially auto expire those depending on, you know, what's going on and where things are sitting. So nice to have. It is gated to Azure AD Premium and it has a couple of I'm not going to complain and I'm not going to call them issues. It has some bugs or some things in it today. So if you do configure this, make sure that all of your groups have valid owners. So if they do not have a valid owner for some reason, you're going to want to go ahead and make sure that that does get in place. And the reason we want to do that is because the expiration emails go out to all of the owners. If there's nobody to respond to the expiration email, the group will be deleted. And that may not be your desired behavior, right? To have things just disappear because they did not have a group owner associated with them, or that group owner was no longer a valid user. The other thing that you might want to do is when you enable this feature, if you choose to and you're licensed for it, which I would encourage anybody to do because it's always nice to have the platform govern itself when we've configured it the right way, is make sure that you are checking your quarantines and kind of your spam and filtering mechanisms. So depending on your tenant and exchange and how things have been set up, and you know, almost by default because of Microsoft's more aggressive spam policies today, some of their own messages get show up as spam, and these tend to be in that kind of class too. So they might end up in a junk email folder or in a quarantine, and if your users aren't regularly checking quarantine, particularly quarantines, right, because they're kind of off to the side and users have to get the email and know to go there. If they're not doing that and it gets deleted because the message just never showed up for them when it really did, that wouldn't be a good thing either.
Yeah. And one nice thing here, you did talk about those getting deleted. If they're not renewed, those are only, they're soft deleted. So they'll still be around for 30 days. If you do realize it got deleted, you need to restore it. It's not like once it deletes, it's completely gone forever. You would have that option to go in, restore it, give it new owners so that it didn't happen again. Again, it's not going to be completely gone.
Totally valid option, right? But you're going to have to train your help desk or whoever responds to that request to say, oh my gosh, the group disappeared. A and B, prepared to potentially address all the other things that come along with that. So if it happened to be a group that was high profile, so you know, you created a group for like HR to be able to respond to employees, and now HR isn't responding and everything's bouncing back, not a good place to be. You know, it's just something to kind of think about and plan for. You know, nothing different than we do in any other environment, but you know, let's plan it before we flip the switch and run it all over.
Absolutely. So another one of these, kind of in that same vein of expiration of content and kind of managing life cycles of your content, there are now retention policies for teams that are rolling out. So this is a good one. This one, I am sure there have been lots of people clamoring for it, especially with the amount of content that can get stored in Teams now. Again, on the back end, some of it's still put in SharePoint, but this adds those retention policies in your security and compliance center. So if you go into data governance and go look at retention policies now, in addition to Exchange, SharePoint, OneDrive, Groups, Skype for Business, Exchange Public folders, you will start seeing things for channel messages in Teams, because again, those are things that aren't stored in SharePoint or Exchange anywhere, as well as those chats in Teams. This is one of those that is currently rolling out. I actually just checked my tenant as we were getting ready for this recording, and I do not have it yet in my tenant, but it is in progress. It's going out. This is going to help you as admins to help with Sarbanes-Oxley, different compliance requirements, and just making sure that content, again, doesn't get deleted. You retain it. I'm looking through the article here. They have all these different retention policies, different settings in there around proactively deciding when to retain content, when to delete it, setting up both the retention or the deletion of it, managing it with PowerShell. So this, it doesn't say where the PowerShell commandlets are going to be. I don't know if those are going to be part of that Teams module or if they're going to be part of Exchange Online, because I think a lot of the security and compliance stuff is in there. Or does that have its own module now?
It has a special module when you connect to the Exchange.
Exchange.
So there's a bunch of things going on here, right? You're getting some coverage for some Teams things, but now you need to understand the architecture of Teams and where your workloads sit. So this will be out by mid-April for hopefully the majority of tenancies. So if you don't see it, you should be seeing it relatively soon over the course of the next couple weeks by the time you hear this. And yeah, just keep in mind that not everything is covered. So where you might be doing channel messages, which are going to be associated with the Exchange mailbox that is associated with your Office 365 group, that is associated with your Microsoft team, right? And driving everything through kind of the underlying Office 365 fabric and chat service and everything there. Other things related to chat live in other places, particularly private messages. If you've started to transition users more and more over to the Teams tenant or Teams application, and that way of doing business, their personal chats are stored in their OneDrive. So you do need to consider retention for OneDrives as well if you want to have full coverage for messages, not just channel messages in the team.
Yep. And they do, in the link that we'll have in the show notes to this, they have a nice graphic too that kind of shows where everything goes as it goes in Teams, whether it goes to Exchange, whether it goes to SharePoint, how some of the Office 365 information protection tools apply to those different ones. And they're just continuing to move forward too with Teams. We kind of saw it starting at Ignite where they're going full bore ahead with Teams. So they're also working on some of the e-discovery for calls and meetings in Teams. That they just say coming soon. Another big ticket item that they say is on the roadmap is the data loss prevention for conversation and files. So they really are investing a lot in Teams and making sure it's compliant and all of those same data protection, data governance tools work just as well in Teams as they do on some of those other Office 365 services.
So let's do one more SharePoint one too while we're in here and talking about Office 365 and all this stuff that ties together. So HubSites has gone to wider availability and is rolled out to, if not 100%, the majority of tenants right now. So this was a feature that was announced back at Ignite, which allows you to have a central site which can drive things like navigation, look and feel with theming, being able to control scope searches, some of that kind of stuff. So basically I have a master site and then I have other site collections that are associated with that hub. What is it up to? 50 subsites that can go ahead and get all that going. So this feature, as it comes out, the way that you kind of go through and spin everything up, there's some new commandlets for being able to register your hub sites. So there's just a register SPO hub site commandlet. I believe I saw something from the PMP folks that they eventually plan to incorporate this functionality over there as well and make it a lot richer on that side because, you know, we've got some other options around theming and site designs and some other stuff where they've done some additional bootstrapping over there. But yeah, pretty much now you can build your hub sites. You can go ahead and begin to associate child sites to those hubs. Just keep in mind, you can only have one child site associated to one hub at a time. So there's not a one-to-many upstream relationship there. Microsoft put out a bunch of webinars and some other things to go ahead and talk about this. They just held a couple of them this week, and they do have recordings available for those. And then, of course, they will be doing some additional guidance on things at the SharePoint conference coming up in May.
This one is interesting. I have this in my tenant. It looks like targeted release should all have it. They were saying mid-March for that, and then complete rollout by mid-May. So another month and a half if you are not on first release or targeted release to get it. But it is. One interesting thing, I guess, based on the announcement, I just kind of envisioned you'd actually create a hub site. But all you do is you specify a current site collection to be a hub site. So I actually go in and either create a group site collection by creating a new group, or that's the way I did it. And then you actually go in and say, okay, now this site collection that I've already created is going to be my new hub site. And then you can go in and associate all your other created site collections with that hub site. So even your hub site, you can still have all the document libraries. It's just a normal site collection that's specified as the hub site. And then once that's all set up, the navigation up at the top changes too, where you can go in and say edit and add the links. And then it shows up on all the child sites of that hub site. It worked really well. I actually even used Valdex, Office 365 CLI, that we talked about with him a couple of weeks back, to create all my hub sites, register it. So he has all of those built in already to the CLI as well for managing them. So it was slick experience, really easy to set up.
Awesome. Yeah, I think one of the kind of only limitations that exists out there today is you can't register your root site collection as the hub, correct?
That's correct. And I don't know, I haven't actually tried to do it with a classic site. Like if you have an old one that you've spun up from the SharePoint Admin Center or one that you've had for a while, if you can actually take a classic SharePoint site, make that a hub site. Again, because with the navigation and the UI, it's all a little goofy. I'm going to assume it probably has to be a modern site, but don't quote me on that.
That's probably a valid assumption. Hopefully there's not too many new classic sites kicking around, or at least most people are kicking the tires on the newer site constructs. So let's go ahead and close out with some Azure stuff. There was a bunch of announcements at the beginning and tail end of this week with some really cool functionality, some that's been in preview and some that customers had never seen before, but now it's kind of just sitting out there ready to go. One of the best ones is probably virtual machine serial console access and having secure access to consoles on your VMs now. So if you are deploying infrastructure as a service workloads, virtual machines in Azure, you might have been frustrated in the past by a VM that was working at one point magically stops booting. And you're like, huh, did it really boot? Or I don't know if it booted. I don't know where it's at. I don't know what it's doing. They added some boot diagnostics and some additional signals into the diagnostic service. And they included things like a boot up screenshot optionally, if you wanted that to happen and had everything configured. A screenshot didn't always show you what was going on, right? If you think about like the Windows boot up process, there are parts of that boot up process where the screen is just blank. So sometimes you would go in and look at your VM and you would say, oh my gosh, it didn't boot, or I just don't know what's going on. And you would go look at the boot up screen and it... Yeah, no, it's not doing anything. So for both Windows and Linux VMs, what they've gone and done is built a console service where you can directly interact with your VMs as a part of the boot up process, or even post-boot if you're trying to do configuration or things like that. So think about wanting like console access from a web portal to hop on and do investigation on a Windows VM. Just go open up the console and you have access to the local file system, things like that with CMD. It works out of the gate for every Linux VM. There's no changes to your existing images. There are some things that you may need to do for Windows VMs, depending on lifecycle and how you deploy. If you turn on a new Windows VM as of this week, it's all set and ready to go. If not, they do have some documentation for how you can go ahead and enable the SAC the secure console and have everything up and running.
Yes, we need people cheering wildly for this. We need like some sound effects here because I know this is one people have been asking for a long time. I honestly had, it would be interesting to see how they do this because I know there were, it sounds like when people first started asking for it, there was quite some engineering that had to take place to get this to work and to work well. I know I could have used it before. I can't remember what I did, but I ended up with a server on a screen where I literally had to go in and like click next or hit a button, but that was before the whole RDP service started up. So I could actually see in my diagnostic window that the machine was up and then I just had to click a next button because of some error or some update or something. And I literally couldn't do it. So I destroyed that VM and had to throw it away because I didn't have that console access to actually keep going through whatever process it was that got hung up.
Yeah, so this is really good for troubleshooting. It is also really good in some other scenarios as well. So one of the biggest ones that I can see is being able to interact with your bootloader. So whether that's BCD or things like RUB in Linux, now you can actually interact with those while your VM is booting. So think like, hey, I need to hit F8 and be able to go and get into a screen. Now that's possible. One of the other big things that comes into play outside of troubleshooting is now you can have fully isolated systems that might even be locked down much more severely on the network side, where you can still interact with those systems to manage them via the console. So like I said, not too bad to spin up. You do have to have boot diagnostics enabled. You do have to have a contributor role or higher on the RBAC side to both the virtual machine and the boot diagnostics account to be able to get access to that. And other than that, you should be up and running. Like I said, works with the majority of Linux distros and Windows, you're covered across the board. So not too shabby.
Nice.
So there was that. And then there was a bunch of other ones around a couple of things with global availability and resiliency of services. So made it in just under the wire for when Microsoft said it was going to do it. But global VNet peering has GA'd. It did go GA with just a handful of regions. But what this lets you do is peer VNets just like that across regions. So I don't need to do any special like IPsec, VPNs, or other tunnels between my VNets anymore. I can just do straight global peers and have access to Microsoft's backbone. So there are some considerations here with things like pricing. So I'm going to have network egress and some other things going on. So, you know, go ahead and check that out. It should be coming to more regions as quick as they can roll it out from everything I'd kind of seen and heard. And then there were a couple updates around zone storage zones as well. One with zone redundant storage, which is now generally available. So if we think about an Azure region, usually I think most folks think like they're deploying into, like you said earlier, like East 2, and they think East 2 is a single data center. It's just like AWS though. East 2 is a collection of one or more independent units. They might be data centers, but they are separate power, separate heating, separate cooling, separate networking that all combine into that region and make it together. So now what you can do is you can target your storage into that level, zone redundant, and you can also do your VMs into availability zones now as well. So in the past, we would do 80 AV sets, availability sets with update domains and fault domains, but we were still within the same data center. We might be like a different rack or things like that within the data center. Now we can stay within the same region and go ahead and push out into multiple zones within that region. And that actually ups your SLA for VMs to 4.9s.
All right. Very cool. Sounds good. Well, I think that about probably wraps us up for the day. Should we tease people about what's going to be on our next episode? Or should we let it be a surprise?
You can go ahead and tease all you want.
I'm not going to tease. Well, now I'm already teasing. You guys are going to have to listen. I'm going to leave it a surprise. We got to leave some mystery.
There you go. Yeah, let's leave it at that.
All right. Yeah, we'll leave it at that. We're going to have a guest on our next episode, but it should be a good one. I'm going to sneak in one more announcement too, because it's my own self-promotion and it's our podcast, so I can do that. I actually just put up on one of my sites too. I have a website up there, office365adminportal.com. that I'm doing some stuff around. If you want to go check it out, we can put a link to it in the show notes. You can go check it out. But I also just published on there my own Getting Started with Office 365 email course. So it's 13 emails, one a day. I do give you the option to skip around through it. But if you want to go check that out. Give me some feedback on it. Let me know what you think. That's up there now too. So something I just did. Yeah, check it out. Go take a peek. And
yeah, I will make sure to get that in the notes for everybody. So notes will be at mscloudipro.com/episode. What's this one going to be?
57.
Episode 57. Yeah.
And I think this might actually be like our 1 year date one too. I think we started like the very beginning of April last year. So we got a few extra episodes than one a week. But I think from a timeline perspective, we have now reached a year.
Perfect.
All right. Well, and with that, we'll wrap it all up and we'll talk to you again next week.
Cool. Yep. Thanks, Ben.
If you enjoyed the podcast, go leave us a 5-star rating in iTunes. It helps to get the word out so more IT pros can learn about Office 365 and Azure. If you have any questions you want us to address on the show or feedback about the show, feel free to reach out via our website, Twitter, or Facebook. Thanks again for listening and have a great day.